Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. The CD, or compact disc, hasn't fared well since the start of the 21st century. Between 2000 and 2010, CD sales dropped by 50% and have continued declining every year since. Once the most popular format of all time, now the CD spins steadily toward obsolescence, which is why producer Taylor Quimby was so surprised when his friend Joe, an early adopter of digital music, said he was thinking about going back to buying CDs.
First of all, you say that you're thinking about buying some CDs.
I actually, since we've talked last, I've bought CDs.
What'd you get?
I got a Kate Bush CD. I got a Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds CD, and I got a Destroyer CD.
Ooh, what Nick Cave?
Let Love In.
Did you own these same CDs before?
Yes.
So you bought CDs that you already owned and sold?
Yeah. Yep. And I probably have them all digitally right now, too, like in my iTunes library.
So, like, this Nick Cave CD that you got.
Right.
You could have listened to that before you left for this store to buy.
Yeah, I could have listened to it on my phone on the way to the store. I could have listened to it. But the thing is, I hadn't listened to Nick Cave in years because I hadn't thought about listening to it.
A thunder on the night of fire and noise. Wild bells rang in a wild sky.
Joe says that around the time Napster was fighting for survival in court, he owned about 1,000 CDs and about 1,000 records on vinyl. When digital music took off, he was one of the first to jump on board. But as Joe and his wife Johanna have moved from MP3 to Pandora to Spotify, they've discovered there is a cost to going digital, and that's why they're rebuilding their collection.
It got to the point where we'd want to put on some music, but we wouldn't know what to put on. We literally could put on almost anything because we had access to it, but we just couldn't choose. Where looking over and just picking out something out of 25 CDs, you know, that seems pretty easy.
Joe isn't the first person to push back against the digital revolution. After all, vinyl has made headlines year after year for increasing in sales, while the music industry overall is hemorrhaging profits. But vinyl is attractive for a reason that CDs are not: nostalgia.
I mean, a lot of people make the argument with records that it's the size, it's a product, there's room for beautiful artwork. You know, I think that makes a lot of sense to me. But I don't necessarily know that I understand the argument to go back to buying CDs.
The argument is, in my mind, it's physical versus digital. I'm drawn to looking at the album, looking at the CD, holding it, you know, feeling it. And like, you know, an old record or even an old CD, I guess at this point, like they have smells, they have age.
The smell of an old CD.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. Maybe it's a thing. I remember Guns N' Roses, Use Your Illusion 1 and 2, they had a certain smell to them.
What do they smell like?
I don't know. I think it's just the printer that they were using, but they had a smell.
Okay, so it's not the smell of Guns N' Roses that pushed Joe to start restoring his CD collection. He and his wife are expecting a baby. This week, actually, and Joe is starting to think about how he discovered music as a kid and the relationship his own son may have with music now that digital is king.
How do you choose cereal? You know, like, I probably spend the most time in the grocery store picking out what cereal I want because there's so many choices. It's overwhelming at times. So picture being a child and picture the cereal aisle is infinitely long. And I remember being a kid myself and going through my parents' records, and I would pick out stuff that just like looked cool, and like Herbie Hancock's Headhunters album, I'd play that all the time, and Piper at the Gates of Dawn by Pink Floyd. Like, I would put on those records because I wanted to listen to them, and I only discovered them because they were there and I felt drawn to them.
It's easy to imagine that obsolescence is a near instantaneous process, As soon as version 2.0 hits the stores, version 1.9 becomes curbside litter on the road to progress. But whether it's your parents' record collection or your first cell phone, we have a way of creating emotional bonds with technology that outlive their physical use. And the collateral damage when we move on isn't always apparent, sometimes until much later. Joe is asking how future generations will engage with music, having never understood albums as physical objects. But questions of obsolescence are everywhere. What will happen to handwritten letters or handwriting? What will taxi drivers do when the driverless car comes of age? Why did the 8-track die out while the cassette tape survives? Today on the show, we're going to continue to explore the concept of obsolescence, and our next guest may have some advice for collectors like Joe. As much as you cherish them, your CDs may be dying. Fenella France is Chief of Preservation Research and Testing at the Library of Congress, where she's been researching how to best preserve CDs by purposefully destroying them.
What we have done here is it was recognized as all times through history that when you have an unstable media, that becomes a challenge in terms of the preservation of the content. And you can think back to acidic paper in the late 19th century. And often this is linked to increased manufacture, some new technology becoming available and sort of mass production. And what we have done here to preserve our collections is we've created a reference scientific study of materials that are not library materials. And we can use those for various testing. And most of our testing is, in fact, non-destructive. To try and predict the age and how long these materials will last, we often do, as well as natural aging, where we just look at things over a period of time, we also do some accelerated aging to try and see what might something look like in 100 years without having to wait 100 years and find out that it might not look that good.
So you're accelerating or simulating aging. I'm curious about what kinds of environmental conditions we might experience in daily life would be bad for CDs.
So essentially we do the aging with increased temperature and relative humidity. The quickest way to try and reduce the life of your CDs is put them in your car over summer, and it's a wonderful little bakehouse. So we generally don't recommend that, but that's what we're doing, because when you increase the temperature, you increase the chemical breakdown of materials. And when you increase the humidity, then often you get, if there's a tiny crack or anything, any sort of defect, then that can get in and delaminate areas and start to cause damage in the material that's actually holding the information on that.
So you mentioned mass production earlier. Now, to the uninitiated, it seems pretty straightforward that to determine the lifespan of a CD, you just have to test a number of CDs out. Now, why is this so complicated?
It's complicated because generally when a new technology comes in, the early materials that are produced are a lot more unstable. Manufacturers are trying to get the edge, and they're trying to see what might be the best composition, because these are laminate materials. They're a composition of different types of materials. And so after the first 5 years or so, quite often the materials become a lot more stable, because by then they've actually figured out what the problems are and they know, how to make them last longer. So it's usually that early time period of production, and we found that also with magnetic tape as well from the early 70s, that's also an issue, because as they made changes when they were manufacturing it, that's when we start to get some of these breakdowns.
We're going to simulate one of your simulations here. The Library of Congress researchers even tested twin copies of some CDs and found out that they performed differently. Here is a little bit of Paul Winter's Grammy-nominated 1987 album, Earthbeat. Okay, so that's hearing the CD. You took two copies of this, made by the same company, wrapped copies, seemingly identical CDs. How did you test them?
We put them into our chamber, our accelerated aging instrument, for about 500 hours at 80 degrees Celsius and about 70 degrees relative humidity. And when we brought them out, we found that one of them actually was pretty good. The other one had oxidized, and the reflective layer had become completely transparent, the metal reflective layer.
So nothing on it.
Nothing on it. Had no material left. So that was really quite an eye-opener. I mean, this really was an extreme case. As I see, quite often some of your CDs may be really quite stable, but that is one of the challenges, as I was saying, that somehow these were manufactured or treated slightly differently, and we didn't have that information.
So 80 degrees Celsius, about 176 degrees Fahrenheit. So we can't say that any CD from that year, 1987 or before, will deteriorate, just some of them. It must be pretty tricky from an archivist point of view.
That's exactly the case, and that's where it does get a little bit frustrating. So, and the other thing that's interesting is there has been that change in thought process where you have to always preserve the original, but as we're realizing with some of these modern materials, the content is really what's critical. So we need to get that content off before we actually lose the original disc or material that it's on. And that's really what we're trying to do, that race against time to make sure that we understand which ones are more at risk and transfer that material first before we deal with other collections. So, for example, DVDs, because they have so much more information on them, are a lot less stable and more prone to damage than the CD.
Wow, so your collection could be kind of dissolving on the shelves.
Well, the Library of Congress, everything that we have here, we actually have more than one copy, and then we have backups as well. Mm. So this, our actual collection, per se, is not at risk, but this is really trying to help anything new coming in and making sure that we make the best decisions.
How about for us listeners, any advice on how we should handle or best preserve CDs?
First off, the one thing that a lot of people want to do is label them. And we found early on that the quickest way to start degradation on a CD is actually just stick a label on the top of it, because you actually then damage. Everyone thinks that it's the lower layer that is most at risk. But in fact, you have two layers. So any scratches in the lacquer layer can damage the metal reflective layer. But if you scratch the substrate layer, then the light from the laser that reads it, can be disrupted. So
the substrate layer meaning the shiny side that's up, we normally think of it plays on the downside.
Right, on the downside. So also scratches in that top layer, the lacquer layer, can damage the reflective.
So in addition to all of the records from members of Congress, I'm just curious, you did get loads of CDs submitted from everyday people. Did you and your colleagues ever put on a certain CD and, have a little dance party, like a pop and lock to Run DMC or, Tears for Fears binge, anything like that?
I wish I could say we did. Unfortunately, we have 158 million objects here at the library, and since the mission of our directorate is to make sure that they're all available in either their original or reformatted form, sadly we don't often get that chance to really sit down and enjoy the material. So at some point I have to come back as just a visitor and get that chance to actually listen and enjoy some of the materials that we're working so hard to try and protect.
Fenella, you and your colleagues keep up the great work.
Thank you so much.
Fenella France, Chief of Preservation Research and Testing at the Library of Congress. She's among those researching the lifespan of compact discs and other recording formats. You can read more about the project. There's a link to the article from The Atlantic. It's at wordofmouthradio.org. There are certain objects, trends, and styles that hold great value long after their shelf life is up. Among them, antique furnishings or craftsman homes or art deco jewelry. But when it comes to technology, it's usually out with the old, in with the new. Up next, a conversation with a photographer who finds great beauty in the items the digital age has discarded. The relics of technology when Word of Mouth continues.
Word of Mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. The floppy disk, the 8-track, slides, the rotary phone, the overhead projector, the pager, the typewriter. You might call these obsolete devices and machines and formats many things, clunky, awkward, or faded, but would you call them beautiful? For his project, Relics of Technology, photographer Jim Golden has been creating a series of GIFs and photographs that put obsolescence under the lens.
I turned 40 in December, and I started looking back on all this technology, and I started thinking about, where it's all gone, who are all the people who used it, all the good times we had with it, or bad times, all the data that we've lost. Another big part of it was, where is all this stuff now? And it's basically like in landfills.
So people who can't see these photographs, would you describe your sort of process? You say, I hand you a stack of Atari cartridges. How would you approach that in your studio?
Okay, so you hand me a stack of Atari cartridges. I'd probably pick out my favorite ones, of course. You know, we'd lay them out in a pattern and photograph them. The pattern thing, I think, is important to catch people's eye, too, because a lot of that stuff isn't so interesting. So when you make one of these patterns with things, people are like, wait a minute, what is that? I kind of know it, and then they stop and take a look, and then, you know, they engage with the photo a little bit. That's the idea behind the whole project, really, is just to get people to take, like, these everyday, overlooked, obsolete objects and just get them to stop for, like, maybe 15 seconds and think, holy smokes, remember when phones were plugged into the wall?
When I look through your photographs, I think of the sort of changes in industrial design and what kind of things look beautiful to me and what kind of things look not so beautiful. I mean, are we going to ever look back at the 8-track cassette and think, wow, that was a really great design, in the same way you'd go back to something of the atomic age and think, wow, a lamp that's shaped like a rocket?
Yeah, I mean, I love 8-tracks because they have artwork big enough to see. I think, you know, we'll go back, you know, and say, these are the things we liked and these are the things we don't. Most definitely. I mean, we already have that, you know, think of like the Pontiac Aztec. It's like the most ugly car in the world, but some people still like it.
How long do you think it's going to take before you could include, say, an early iPod or one of the first tablets in your collection? In other words, how long does it take for something to cross over to becoming a relic?
I was in a rental photo studio last week for a photo shoot, and there was the original iPod on the counter as the stereo. And I immediately thought, man, I should have photographed one of those. Like the wheel that spun around. They're just,
yes,
so
the click
already
wheel.
The click wheel. They're only, 10 years old, 12 years old, and it already feels like ancient. I don't know. But then I saw BlackBerry the other day, and I thought that was kind of ancient, too.
Photographer Jim Golden, thank you very much for your time, and what a great project.
Thanks so much. Thanks for having me on, Virginia.
Now you can see pictures from Jim's series, Relics of Technology. There's a link at wordofmouthradio.org. There's the floppy disk and the pager, and then there are those everyday objects that are unlikely to become obsolete anytime soon. Think the zipper or the umbrella or duct tape or towels. Why do they sail through the years unchanged? Producer William Hammack ponders one such seemingly eternal object.
In their movie The Coconuts, one of the Marx brothers asked, why a duck? In the same spirit, I ask today, why a chair? Oddly, I think the Marx Brothers' question might be easier to answer, but I'll give it a try. It seems, of course, that a chair is a natural response to how we bend at our ankles, knees, and hips, but it isn't at all. One thing is for certain. Our use of the chair was nurtured by our response to social, not genetic or anatomical forces. There is much evidence that people raised in a society that squats are perfectly comfortable and healthy. In fact, it's a natural thing for children to do until the chair conditions it right out of them. And there is much evidence that often it's better not to sit. For example, recumbent bikes where the rider leans back are thought safer, speedier, and more efficient. So why a chair? The chair has been around since ancient times, although never an essential part of a household. In Rome, for example, the bed was the all-purpose piece of furniture. Besides sleeping in it, a Roman would eat, read, and write on their beds. The chair made few steps forward for many centuries, even taking some steps backwards. In the 7th and 8th centuries, Arab conquerors, a desert people with no steady wood supply, replaced the chair-level ways of the pre-Islamic Middle East with floor-level seating. It wasn't until the 19th century that the chair began to dominate among furniture. The Industrial Revolution propelled the chair into our homes, partly because mass production made chairs cheaper, but also because work itself changed. Work took place at assembly lines and in offices, work often done seated in chairs. And it looks as if the chair is now unstoppable. Chairs are locked into our architecture. Windows are set in buildings such that we have to sit 18 inches off the ground, and the chair is firmly ingrained in our culture. University professors hold chairs, and we have chairmen, chairwomen, and chairpeople, and as in outgrowth, county seats, district seats, and seats on the stock exchange. In fact, the chair has become so potent a symbol of westernization that Gandhi, and more recently the Ayatollah Khomeini, were always photographed sitting on the floor rather than in a chair. Even in Japan, the chair is taking over. Many households have both rooms with the traditional mats and Western rooms with chairs. But now younger people are finding it difficult to sit on the ground, so the mat rooms are disappearing. By now, we are shaping the chair less and less, and the chair is shaping us more and more. Certainly, we sit too much, since some 30% of Americans are now obese.
William Hammack there on the everlasting power of the chair. Up next, we're going to look into something that is threatened, but not quite dead yet. Handwriting. That's after the news, when word of mouth continues.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Is teaching handwriting still necessary in the digital age? That question routinely resurfaces in opinion columns and parenting blogs. Arguments for teaching penmanship tend toward the need for individual expression or for developing skills independent of digital media. Others find handwriting inessential, a relic of the past that robs classroom time from more practical learning. These arguments may be moot, given the Common Core standards, which have now been adopted in most states. The standards call for teaching legible writing only in kindergarten and first grade. After that, focus shifts to proficiency on the keyboard. Maria Konnikova wrote about research that links handwriting to learning for the Science Times. Word of Mouth spoke to her previously about her book Mastermind, How to Think Like Sherlock Holmes. Maria, great to have you back with us.
Great to be here, Virginia.
So broadly, what are psychologists and neuroscientists finding about the benefits of handwriting?
Well, they're finding that handwriting has benefits at two stages. First, when you don't even know how to read yet, when you take preliterate children, teaching them how to write by hand activates the same neural circuits that adults who can read and write more fluently activate. But teaching them to type on a keyboard doesn't have that same effect. So what we see is that children who first learn their letters by hand are going to be learning to read faster than those children who just reproduce them on the keyboard.
Let's dig into that a little bit. You wrote about research from Indiana University that actually measured brain responses to kids while writing. Can you tell us about that experiment?
Sure. So the experimenter there, Dr. Karen James, looked at three different conditions. She took children who didn't know how to read at all, so they had no idea that what they were copying was, say, the letter A, and she had them either type it on the keyboard, trace it, so you had, you know, those little dots that you probably remember having to connect at some point in your early elementary education.
Oh, yes.
Or you drew it freehand. And she found that only in the freehand condition, so not typing and not tracing, did children activate those brain circuits that we've been talking about, the ones that are associated with reading and writing in adults. And she speculates that that has to do with both the motor memory, so you're really doing this for yourself, and also the messiness. So when you are 3 or 4 years old and you're drawing an A, it's not a very nice A, but you need to learn that that representation is the exact same thing as that beautifully typed A that you see, you know, on the piece of paper in front of you. And when you learn to recognize all of those messy things as one, that really helps you retain, oh, okay, this is the representation of that letter.
Ah, yes, because you see kids' handwriting and it's often backwards R's and N's, so they're kind of working their way through that.
Exactly. So they're teaching themselves how to recognize it. And they're teaching also that this isn't just a picture, you know, this is something that has meaning. That's a process that everyone has to go through.
So it isn't just the recognition of letter as letter, but the actual writing of it. Dr. James also did some studies that illuminated that. Kids have to do it rather than watching it happen.
Absolutely. If you just watch someone else doing it, then you don't have the motor memory yourself, and you don't develop that same fluency that you do if you yourself are writing. So it's not enough to just watch your teacher writing this on a blackboard and then copying it nicely on your laptop or your tablet. You need to write that letter by hand.
Okay, so you just mentioned typing on a keyboard, mm-hmm. but there's also some evidence that there's a distinction between printing and cursive, which, of course, is another issue that brings out the ire of many people, that we're no longer teaching cursive or typing on a keyboard.
Yes, that's absolutely true. We do see evidence that cursive might have additional benefits that are distinct from the benefits that you get just from writing by hand, whether it's cursive or not. And what we see is that cursive may be tied to increased executive control, so your ability to exercise self-control, because it's, you know, it's a harder, more effortful process. And we also see that if children have developmental disabilities, such as dyslexia or dysgraphia, teaching them to write by cursive can help you get through some of the stumbling blocks that would otherwise slow you down and keep you from being able to read and write fluently.
How about, Maria, beyond those early learning years, you know, kids who are already through the printing cursive, grammar mm-hmm. school age, or even adults?
Absolutely. Well, there's some great new work on that by Pam Mueller from Princeton University and Daniel Oppenheimer. And what they found is that adults and students in college who take notes at a lecture on their laptop or by hand have very, very different memory results. So the ones who take notes by hand retain the ideas much better and process the material much better, in the sense that they actually understand what they're hearing, they make connections, and later on, if you ask them 1 week later, 2 weeks later, what they learned, they'll be able to give you a pretty good account. If they take those notes on the laptop, that effect disappears because it's almost too efficient. You don't have to think through it. You can just brainlessly type, and you can type. Most people can type much faster than they write, so you can just do it without really thinking through it, and then you know, the information is just going in one ear and out the other.
I'm curious about advocates for letting go of teaching handwriting. Any responses to these studies, or are they all too new?
I think they're all too new. And, you know, I found personally some responses which basically miss the point and say, well, yes, but computers are the future, just disregarding completely all of these added benefits. And I'm not saying don't teach typing, don't teach computer use. That's incredibly important. All I'm saying is that these aren't substitutions. You have to still write by hand. You have to still know how to do that. Otherwise, you're going to suffer in the long term.
Probably no changes to the core curriculum very quickly then.
No, probably not. And it's very funny because some of the most supportive comments I've received on this article come from teachers who say, hey, we know all about this. We know it's very important. But then you start wondering, you know, who's putting together the core curriculum requirements if all the teachers disagree with them.
Well, that is a whole other issue to unpack. Maria Konnikova, contributing writer for The New Yorker Online. You'll find a link to read her article, What's Lost as Handwriting Fades, as well as an extended conversation on the subject from the Science Times podcast. That link is at wordofmouthradio.org. Maria, thank you very much for speaking with us today.
Thank you, Virginia.
You'll also find a link to hear our interview with Maria about her book, Mastermind, How to Think Like Sherlock Holmes. That's at wordofmouthradio.org. And now to a mode of transportation that has been on life support since the 1960s, the American Railroad. In 1956, President Eisenhower enacted the Interstate Highway System, allowing for 41,000 miles of continuous pavement across America and leaving empty rail cars in its wake. When it comes to commuting today, the car reigns. 86% of Americans get to work by car. So in a world dominated by cars, why does train travel continue to capture the American imagination? Hank Rosenfeld climbed aboard Amtrak's number 4 Southwest Chief to bring us the story.
Welcome aboard train number 4, the Southwest Chief, headed for The Windy City to Chicago, Illinois.
There are only three transcontinental trains left in this country, the Empire Builder, the Sunset Limited, and the one I'm on, Amtrak train number 4, which leaves Union Station out of L.A. once a day, heading east, pulling out just before sunset. Very romantic. First stop, Burbank. All for the one online rail sale price of $58.60 one way. I will meet and fall in love with just about everybody on this trip. That's my tape of one railroad storyteller, Lord Buckley. Yep, and I got my Old Brother, Where Art Thou soundtrack, my Joseph Campbell Transformation of Myth Through Time lectures, and I even got a copy of Thornton Wilder's one-act, Pullman Car Hiawatha. I'm settling into the clickety-clack with the stars and the clouds to read. Oh, and I've brought along a book my brother gave me, Short Lines, a collection of classic American railroad stories. Because believe it or not, brothers and sisters, there was a time 100 years ago when the influence of the railroad on the lives of Americans was at its height. Well, that's what the book says here. Conductor Charles Washington.
How you doing, Bill?
Good.
This your first trip on Amtrak? Yeah? You're going to really enjoy it.
Yeah, soon Conductor Charles is highballing and pulling back the skin on it. That's train transfer, getting out of town fast. Oh, I know what you're thinking. Ooh, Amtrak, bad, bankrupt, boondoggle. Well, sure, compared to Europe and Canada and maybe Greece and other countries. But you ever been on a train in Guatemala? Here's Sally, 15. Do you have trains in Guatemala?
We used to have, but they canceled them.
Sally and her whole family of traveling Guatemalan actors, they're all completely adorable. The Teatro Familia Gomez, Nettie, Sally, and her brother, Luis.
Ven a Burger King. Disfruta las hamburguesas de aquí.
Luis does Burger King voiceovers that play on TV and radio all over Central and South America. I give his mother, Nettie, my business card. My grandparents used to take the train from Detroit to New York City. On New Year's Eve, 1943, they rode in to watch the ball drop after coffee and cheesecake at Lindy's, they said, the place with the singing waiters. They'd stay at the Navarro Hotel on Central Park and go to Nathan's for corned beef. But as my grandfather always says, that's a long time ago. Railroads used to inspire this country. 50-ton locomotives hauling hundreds of tons of iron rail through the Sierras. Today it's all motion, everybody moving, that's what I notice. We may be going to Chicago or to shop, going to war, or just going home. Everybody's on the go. Everything's accelerated, says Paul Krasner, including the rate of acceleration.
Sentimental Johnny!
Our first selection tonight is going to be blackened catfish, and vegetarian instead of penne pasta will be three cheese.
The best thing on Amtrak is the food. Well, besides sneaking between cars at night, going down there and opening up the windows to get the blast of night air in. And there are a few things finer than riding along these rails, staring out the window with a glass of red wine, staring out at the green-gray countryside going by after sunset with the, from the dining car of a train, a couple of evening planets popping up out there. Dining car dinners can stretch for hours, miles, and towns and counties.
Please limit your after-meal conversation.
And then we're going to show Cinderella 2. And then immediately following that will be Ocean's 11, both upstairs and downstairs.
It's night. And at night on trains, people go to sleep. Finding my way to an empty seat, passing everybody sleeping this way and that. And the train shakes, so walking back is like being drunk. Imagine the same walk after some wine. I'm rocking along this little neighborhood that never was and only exists in the time it takes to walk coach after coach through the train. There's always one guy on his computer.
Are you writing a novel?
Yes, actually, I am.
Are you that famous best-selling author, Neville?
I'm the famous best-selling author that hasn't been discovered yet.
The next morning, I start running a tab in the snack bar car, and I see my Guatemalan friends.
So how did you sleep last night?
Really not good. No.
A Zuni guide climbs aboard and narrates the train from Gallup to Albuquerque, and he plays real good flute for free. I meet Anthony, who just got out of prison the day before. He told me the number of jailed Americans has more than doubled in the past 12 years. He was in for 6 on cocaine conspiracy in Lompoc, California. Anthony told me about Eugene Debs, who helped organize the very first strike against the railroads, and said, as long as there is a soul in prison, I cannot be free. So I had a good follow-up. I asked Anthony what his first meal in freedom was. He said, the chicken fingers at Burger King.
Ben at Burger King.
Nice way to reacclimate, I told him. But inside I'm thinking, we're down to chicken strips as a way to celebrate freedom? No wonder the airplane people sneer at us train folk.
Hi, my name is Lavie. I'm on the train going to St. Louis to visit my family. I'm 4'8", good looking, got long hair.
Lavie's 11. He likes Exhibit.
X-Z-I-B-I-T.
His cousin Stevie Mack is 15. They both play football for the San Bernardino Bears. Nice kids.
Can you do one of your numbers for me?
One of my numbers?
What do you call it? A song? I don't know. Your joints, I think they call it today, right? Joints?
It's murder when you step a foot on my block. It's murder when you hear Trey shots. It's murder when you hear knock knock. It's murder when my gun go click clack and spark. I bet not see you young niggas at the door, because I'm going to let my heat bark.
I'm going to let my heat bark?
Bark.
Bark.
It's great, the kind of stuff you find out about on trains. Listen to LaVie, 11-year-old freestyler.
Like me now, I go T for my style, take you in the backyard while you up like Allen Iverson. Number 3, you can't see me, they call me Lil LaVie. Stevie Mack, kick a flow right next to me.
So by the time we arrive in Chicago, we're only 24 minutes late. And that's like early in Amtrak time. Way early. On the way through Illinois, we passed 50 sandlot ball fields, and not one of them had a game going on. I saw some deer running from the tracks. I saw moms in parking lots pausing to point us out to her kids. That's an Amtrak, she said. The last of a dying breed. Anyway, I finally got around to reading Thornton Wilder's Pullman Car Hiawatha. A great train ride one-act play, whose characters include a field the train passes through, archangels, all the planets. Like much of Thornton Wilder's works, it's about life and death. And there's a porter in this play that yells, Chicago, Chicago, all out, this train don't go no further. Rudyard Kipling once said a locomotive is next to a marine engine, the most sensitive thing man ever made. That's what he said. I think he might be right.
Well, I ride on a mail train, babe. Can't buy a thrill.
That audio postcard came from journalist Hank Rosenfeld after he climbed aboard Amtrak's number 4 from Los Angeles to Chicago. From the allure of train travel to vintage clothes and home furnishings, nostalgia is a powerful force. We all love our keepsakes, but there are those who hold on to the past with a death grip. Up next, a conversation with a man who holds the Guinness World Record for largest video game collection. That's when Word of Mouth continues.
Word of Mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Today, we're exploring obsolescence from a number of different perspectives, including the practical and the emotional and the economic. While some obsolete items get thrown into the junk heap, others grow in value and become collectibles. 2 years ago, Forbes magazine predicted that the global video game industry will hit $82 billion by 2017. Though much of that revenue will come from gaming on mobile platforms, there's still a group of gamers dedicated to consoles, even retro consoles. Michael Thomason holds the Guinness Book of World Records record for largest video game collection. He had 10,607 games when he won the title. He's now well over 11,000. And Michael Thomason, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you.
When did you start collecting video games?
Well, it was in the early 80s. I asked for a ColecoVision from my parents for Christmas, and I didn't get it, but I did get a game, and I read the manual and looked at the box for a year until the following holiday when I did.
And you thought, I'm on to something?
Well, I don't think I realized what kind of ball I was getting rolling, but yes, it has consumed my life.
So you started as a player. Have you played every game in your collection?
I have not. How many copies of Mary-Kate and Ashley does a grown man need, right? but I have played the majority of them. I'd say I've probably played a good 70 to 80% of them.
How many of them can still be played? I mean, many games could only be played on old consoles or old school TVs, which don't plug into today's monitors.
Well, I can play all of them. There's workarounds for most systems, but what's really elusive is some of the early Japanese systems.
It sounds like the collection of this scale must be very expensive. Many of the games still obsolete. Why are people willing to shell out big bucks for them?
I don't know, because I'm not one of those people. You know, I've been doing this for 35 years, and I bought them. They were cheap, and I bought them before it kind of became in vogue, right? You know, when I was playing and playing the games, I was still what we call a basement player, because you were ashamed to come out in public, right? Let people know you played video games. But the industry's grown up, and Sony came along and made it cool. So now there's a demand, right?
Well, it looks as though your collection is still in your basement. I mean, I watched a video of you and a load of friends counting your collection. And I wonder, do your friends think, you know, this is kind of an eccentric habit? Or do they come by and want to borrow games from you or play on your consoles?
Well, it's funny. Until I went for the Guinness, none of my friends even knew I had the amount of games that I had. I always kind of kept it quiet. So a lot of them were quite shocked when the moment came. And they were invited to be part of the Guinness event. You know, it's the most common pastime in the world for entertainment. You know, it eclipses movies and television combined. But I can't seem to find a good, steady player here since I moved to New York. So,
well, Michael, you've had to sell off portions of your collection twice in the past. That must have hurt. Can you tell us how you decided what to sell and why you had to sell them?
Well, the first time I sold my games, it was pretty easy because it was right after the game crash in the mid-80s, and there weren't any new games coming out. And about that time, I was a teenager, and I got in a car and discovered freedom and learned about girls, right? And so I wasn't really focused on the gaming. Years later, we just hit our 14th anniversary. My wife and I got married. And, you know, a wedding's expensive, and there's more than just the actual wedding costs. So I didn't sell off my complete collection then, but I sold off three complete sets, which was probably about a third of the collection to help out.
Well, you managed to recoup almost all of the games you sold. Now, why go through that effort to get back all of the same games instead of just going and buying new ones?
Well, I bought the same games and new ones. Kind of funny, one of the games that I sold it for $100 and now sells for over $3,000.
Wow.
Is a game called Magical Chase, which is kind of funny because that's the kind of chase I'm on trying to buy it back.
Now, is this like asking if you have a favorite child, if you have a favorite game in your collection?
I do. And until a couple of years ago, I really didn't have a favorite. And a big franchise is Resident Evil. And I played them and I thought they were good. But when Resident Evil 4 came out, I was floored. That's what I call the perfect game. And right behind it is a game called Alan Wake. It's not well known, but it's like a Stephen King book on the screen. It's interactive. It's beautiful.
Well, Michael Thomason, what a pleasure talking to you. Congratulations on your record.
Thank you so much.
Michael Thomason is a video game historian and an adjunct professor of digital media arts at Canisius College. That's in Buffalo, New York. He's also Guinness Book of World Records holder for largest video game collection. You can find more, including a link to a video chronicling his win at wordofmouthradio.org. A little postscript to that story. After we spoke with Michael Thomason, we saw that he'd put his entire video game collection online. We asked him why, and in an email he wrote, quote, "I have obligations to those I love, and selling the collection is one way of meeting them. I want my daughter to go to Catholic school." Well, the starting bid was $1, and at last check, the bidding was at $750,000 with 3 days to go. The bidding ends this Sunday at 10:30 p.m. Pretty safe to say his daughter is going to be attending a really good Catholic school. Well, that about does it for today's show on obsolescence. And we leave you with a few sounds that are now gasping their last breath. Thank you. So glad you could join us today. I'm so glad we're not dead yet. We'll be back with more Word of Mouth Saturday at noon, right here on NHPR.